political capital, not only across the global south, across Eurasia, from West Asia to East Asia, in Africa, but also in the global north. Don't forget that in Europe, Lula is a mega superstar. Everywhere he goes, you know. So the goodwill from the European Union, not only from individual nations like France, Germany, Spain, Italy, Britain, etc., but from Brussels itself towards Lula is enormous. So he can get away with almost anything. And get away means in terms of being a social justice, a sustainable development, eradication of poverty, of course. And he'll have to make some concessions in terms of climate change and the administration of the Amazon, which is an extremely touchy subject. Because for Brazilians, if you ask any Brazilian, the Amazon is Brazilian. It's not a conglomerate or a consortium where somebody from Norway comes here and says, okay, you're going to run it this way. No, it's not like that.
Right.
So Lula is going to have to make some concessions, especially towards the Europeans, for managing the Amazon. But if he can get the other parts of his internal agenda done, which is basically social justice and eradication of poverty and full employment and decent salaries, including a decent, a basic minimum wage. For him, it's okay. You know, internationally, it's great because now comes the interesting part for the third Lula term. Let's put it this way: he's going to be one of the leaders of the global south.
Exactly.
Xi Jinping loves him. Vladimir Putin loves him. Right. I'm sure President Raisi will get along.
Yeah, we like him in Iran. We like him here.
Loves him. Modi loves him. So everybody's on his side.
Right.
And of course, he's extremely respected because he's one of the founders of BRICS.
Exactly. You
and
said the magic
words. BRICS, as you well know, is going to become BRICS Plus starting next year.
Just for our audience, the two countries that were officially invited were Argentina and Iran.
Maybe going to have Iran soon as well.
Exactly.
Everybody is on the line. The queue to join BRICS grows literally on a day-to-day basis. You know.
Right.
So everybody sees that BRICS is one of the foundation stones of the multipolar world, along with this Shanghai Cooperation.
With the B of BRICS being Brazil and being the big...
The B of BRICS being Brazil. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, And soon we're going to get to 8, 10, 12, 15 nations easily.
Exactly.
And Lula is going to be a major articulator of BRICS expansion because he has good relations with all these nations, not mentioned with the top three BRICS, Russia, China, and India.
Correct.
So his international role will certainly be much more... in fact, the whole planet would see it. Internally, as we discussed, it's going to be extremely tough. So if he manages to pass his minimalistic agenda, it will be already a victory, which at this stage means a decent minimum wage. There's a policy called Bolsa Família, family books, let's put it this way, which assures a minimum wage for a family as long as they put their kids in school.
Right.
You know, these are very, very important. If he keeps these programs, it will be already a victory for him. In terms of, for instance, stopping wild privatization of top Brazilian companies, this is going to be very, very hard. He may do it. For instance, he may prevent Petrobras, the Brazilian energy giant, from being privatized. That will already be an enormous victory. And the money coming from the exploitation of the pre-salt oil reserves coming more towards Brazil than going to shareholders all over the world. You know. This is his margin of maneuver. He's restricted, but he can do it. Because if he gets the what we call the big center, center left or right political parties in Congress and in the Senate, they can rally behind him. As long as he sells it in terms of this is for Brazilian national interests. So he has at least the beginnings of a deal, you see. But it's going to be very tough.
Okay, so Pepe, we have about 5-6 minutes left. So let's step back again a little bit and let's try to see if we can come up with some, how should we call it, some sort of a conclusion about what we see the future to be like. So in a sense, you're saying, and please correct me if I'm wrong, so you're saying internally it's going to be a modest level. In other words, the expectations have to be modest, but if you can do the minimum, that's good enough for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
But in terms of internationally, the way we see the world changing and changing very quickly, this is actually a key 4 years now that we have in this change of the multipolar world. Before the program we talked, you mentioned President Putin talking about the next years being very dangerous years.
The most dangerous decade after World War II.
Exactly.
And he's absolutely correct.
So please, if you could, in the time that we have left, give us a little, let's look into the future. We always try to look in the future in our program. Give us maybe the next 10 years, how it's going to be, both internally in Brazil and also in terms of Brazil's place in this new changing order. Is this kind of fascist, racist side of Brazil, is that going to again be able to, you know, with whatever tricks they have, come back and make a comeback? Or is that era or that period maybe coming to an end, given the changes that are happening in the world? And if Lula and his successors are capable of implementing at least the basics of their programs?
Well, I hate crystal balls. I deal with reality.
I know, but I'm asking you to please look into the crystal ball.
Exactly. You have to stick to the facts and and go straight to the point. But okay, if you allow me a little bit of stargazing.
Yes, please.
At the moment. Internally, the polarization of Brazil won't disappear as much as the internal polarization of the empire in the U.S. won't disappear.
Right.
We're going to have to live with it. These are extremely polarized, radicalized, and very violent societies. Brazil can be a very violent country, especially in the big cities.
Right.
De facto division between the center and the southeast compared to the north and the northeast. The country is basically divided in two like this. It's a line like that. It's very, very hardcore. And the possibilities of a sort of entente, like the French say, a dialogue, are very, very slim.
Sorry, Pepe, just to clarify, you're saying that the north and the northeast are poorer, the poorer regions, and the south is...
yes, exactly.
Please explain that for the people who are not from Brazil.
Yeah, of course. I'm sorry about that. But okay, essentially, these focus of racism, especially, and white supremacy,
mm-hmm.
and... with overt fascistic and neo-Nazi overtones, you find them mostly in the south of Brazil.
Right.
European colonization. Don't forget
Correct.
That.
Yes.
A lot of German colonization, Polish, there are Ukrainians as well, you name it. São Paulo is very complicated. São Paulo is the richest state in Brazil. The city is one of the biggest cities in the world. The level of industrialization in São Paulo is ahead of most European countries, in fact. And, of course, it's very divided. There is a sense of self-entitlement. Like, if you are from São Paulo, you consider yourself superior to average Brazilians, especially Brazilians who come from the impoverished northeast, who come to São Paulo to, you know, make their lives and make some money, and sometimes in many cases become rich. So this is not going to disappear.
So there's you're saying it's extremely polarized?
Regional prejudice.
Right. So you're saying it's extremely polarized. This is not going to go away.
Extremely polarized. And the northeast, the poorest part of Brazil, happens to be the region of Brazil that basically elected Lula. Again,
right.
Lula comes from the Brazilian northeast. He's a typical example of an immigrant that comes from an impoverished immigrant that comes from the northeast, goes to the south, and in his case, he didn't become rich, but he became politically powerful and extremely influential in
right.
São Paulo. He built his career in the Detroit of São Paulo. You
yes.
know the car manufacturing
right.
suburbs of São
so,
Paulo.
So you're saying that the polarization will continue, Is there positives that we can talk about in the future for Brazil?
I am very, very sorry, I don't want to be nihilistic.
It's okay. Tell us what you think.
I don't see many positives because don't forget that, very, very important, from the point of view of the owners of the backyard,
yes,
up north,
yes,
losing Brazil is beyond anathema.
Right.
It will never happen.
It's a major red line.
Every trick in the book that you can imagine, using their local comprador elites, their right. fifth columnist, sixth columnist.
So you don't think, Pepe, because we don't have a lot of time, you don't think that this changing multipolarism with BRICS and the feeling that many people in the world have that Brazil is an integral part of this new multipolar world, you don't think that that's going to be a strong enough force to counterweight?
Okay, so, jumping to a slightly rosier picture for the near future.
Yes.
Brazil can attract a lot of direct foreign investment.
Correct.
Not only from China, but also from Russia and from many other BRICS nations. So BRICS will end up working for Brazil. For instance, if you have Iran entering BRICS, Saudi Arabia, etc., you can have direct investment from Saudis, from Iranian business concerns in the enormous Brazilian market, which is not only Brazilian market, it's a South American market.
So just to emphasize your point, it seems to me that even a person like Bolsonaro was aware that BRICS is key to Brazil's future. Even he couldn't
do much. First of all, because he didn't understand BRICS at all. Second, because his handlers up there will never allow him the margin of maneuver, the necessary margin of maneuver.
Right.
Exactly.
So he was not dumb. So to sum it up, Pepe, so we can say that we're going to be witnessing this ongoing conflict between the pressures that come from the U.S. and those elites that have this deep connection with the U.S. and Brazil, versus this growing multipolarism, which everybody in the world believes that Brazil is an integral part of it, and the changes that will come.
Absolutely correct.
So this
will be the tension.
Let's hope that the result of that tension is positive for Brazil. And we have to leave it at that, I think. There's not much. I think that we can conclude with that positive note, if we're going to try to conclude it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Pepe.
Pleasure. And I hope I answer at least some of your questions. Brazil is a very, very complicated affair.
Well, I think the thing that I realized is we need to do another program because we just started to scratch the surface. So hopefully we'll do another program in a year. Let's see how things happen in a year. We can do another program. Thank you so much for joining us on Insight.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So what insight did we gain from our conversation with Pepe Escobar? Contrary to the stereotypical image most have of Brazil, this geostrategically very important nation is in fact a socially and culturally deeply divided nation. The powerful US-backed army and traditional economic elites are still not fully capable of accepting that the majority of the poorer population in that country has gained significant political power after the end of the US-backed military dictatorship. This reality being most clearly manifested in the recent election victory and now third presidential term of former labor leader Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. In addition to this domestic state of affairs, Brazil is one of the key countries in the shaping of a new post-American multipolar world, being one of the founders of the BRICS Forum alongside Russia, India, and China. A forum which will experience further expansion in the near future with the addition of strategically important countries such as Iran, Argentina, Algeria, and Turkey. The next few years will show whether Brazil is capable of participating in the emergence of a new multipolar world as one of the new emerging global powers, or whether the US-backed Brazilian military and traditional economic elites will keep Brazil within the U.S. sphere of influence by any means necessary. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, we talked about Imam Khomeini's simple way of living and how careful he was in sticking to simplicity in every aspect of his life. In today's episode, we are going to discuss the events related to the liberation of Khurramshahr. Stay tuned, please. The liberation of Khurramshahr was without doubt the turning point in the history of the 8-year imposed war and one of the most important events of the history of the Islamic Revolution. Khurramshahr was occupied by the invading Iraqi army 35 days after the start of the invasion and Saddam's all-out war against the Islamic Republic of Iran. This, while the Ba'athist dictator had said that his army would occupy Khurramshahr in one day, the whole Khuzestan province in 3 days, and the entire Iran in 2 weeks, thanks to the stiff resistance of the people of the port city and the all-out support of the Iranian nation and the Iranian army. The Iraqi army intended to occupy Khurramshahr and then Abadan, Ahvaz, and Susangerd very fast, as it considered the move as a strategic victory. The invading army had dispatched 2 battalions at first, but facing the firm resistance of brave Iranian youth, sent more than 2 divisions to the region. The main bridge of Khurramshahr was closed 3 days before the final occupation of the city. Popular forces resisted bravely against aggressors, but after joining the Iraqi 11th Infantry Division to the besiegers, the city fell. Khurramshahr was occupied, but the people's resistance forced Saddam to retreat from his stance and be content with besieging Abadan. The strategic port of Khurramshahr was occupied for 576 days, and finally it was liberated on May 24, 1982, in Baitul Muqaddas operation. The beautiful port city had ruined into a ruin, and the only undestroyed building was the main mosque of the city. The broadcasting of the news of liberation of Khurramshahr was the most joyous news during the 8-year war. It caused people distribute sweets and nuts and hold feasts on the streets of every city. People chanted Allahu Akbar on the roofs of houses. The liberation of Khurramshahr was a very big blow to the Iraqi army and Saddam himself. It seriously weakened the morale of the invading army. This day has been dubbed as the Day of Resistance, Self-Sacrifice, and Victory in the Iranian calendar. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, strongly believed that Khurramshahr was liberated by God. He wrote in his congratulatory message to the Iranian nation, "With certain belief in the ayah, there is no victory but from Allah, I thank the children of Islam and the valorous armed forces who were the means of God's power and who took out the country of the Imam of the Age from the clutches of cannibalistic wolves, which are puppets in the hands of superpowers, especially America, and who caused the chant of Allahu Akbar echo over the fresh city Khurramshahr that had plunged in blood by the wicked Western criminals and was called Khuni Shahr, or Bloody City. Imam Khomeini's wife was in the holy city of Mashhad on the day of liberation of Khurramshahr. But as soon as hearing this exhilarating news, she bought some sweets and gave them to be distributed among people. After the liberation of Khurramshahr, the renowned poet, late Muhammad Hossein Shahryar, came to Imam Khomeini's office to read and offer his recent poems for the Imam. The poems were full of praise for the Imam, but the whole time that Shahryar was reciting the poems, Imam Khomeini had put his head down with a gloomy and sad face. After finishing his poems, the Imam told him, "I thought that you had composed poems on liberators of Khurramshahr." Shahryar answered, "I have composed for the commander of the liberators of Khurramshahr." This was Imam Khomeini's usual reaction to those who praised him in their poems or speeches. He used to say that God has done everything and we are nothing before him.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
This Christmas is not a time for cheers and festivities for many in the U.S. A hunger crisis is affecting U.S. households. Food insecurity is already a critical problem affecting millions of Americans. One of the most typical factors affecting people suffering from food insecurity this time of the year are extreme winter conditions. But this year especially, many are suffering from hunger and high food prices due to unprecedented inflation that has gripped the U.S.
The gas, the food, everything, milk, egg, everything is high now.
It is concerning, so I always shop online to make sure that I can find the best prices for groceries and for, like, gas as well.
Last year, more than 33 million Americans lived in food-insecure households, including 9 million children. The figure dropped in 2021, thanks to COVID relief programs. One also does not need to look any further than U.S.'s food assistance program called SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, to see the severity of the problem. The federal government increased SNAP by 12.5% this fall, adjusted to the rate of inflation. In the fiscal year 2021, SNAP served an average of 41.5 million people per month. the U.S. President Joe Biden may boast of a minor drop in inflation.
And yesterday, we got that data that showed that manufacturing orders were up, but cost increases in supply chain items were beginning to ease. The week before that, we got data showing that price increase may be beginning to ease as well.
But the fact of the matter is that the U.S. population is suffering from poverty, unemployment, a lack of affordable housing, and lack of access to health care. This is on top of systemic racial inequities. All of these factors have driven food insecurity that affects around 10% of U.S. households. Many people in the UK are also struggling to make ends meet during Christmas time, especially when it comes to food. That is since the UK economy is suffering from negative economic growth that has led many to be food insecure. Driven mainly by soaring energy prices, UK inflation has been running high in 2022, reaching successive new records. In October, households paid 88.9% more on average for electricity, gas, and other fuels than a year ago. So it is natural then that there has been a multifold increase when it comes to people going to food banks. One sobering statistic is that there are now more food banks than McDonald's in the UK. Between April and September, more than 320,000 people in the UK walked into food banks of Trussell Trust, a leading charity fighting against hunger, for the first time, and 1.3 million emergency food parcels were provided across the country. Yet it appears that in the UK, things are a lot worse when it comes to energy bills, especially during the winter time. Families across the UK have to juggle household incomes and make a choice between staying warm or buying food.
So across the UK, we have what we call fuel poverty, which is if you have to spend 10% of your income to afford a decent level of heat and power, you're regarded as being in fuel poverty. September 2021, there are about 4 million households across the UK in fuel poverty.
And that is quite a startling fact, considering how the UK is part of the G7 group of countries. Total wages in the UK have also fallen by 3.9% annually in the quarter to October, accounting for inflation, making the cost of living crisis worse for the average Brit. The natural question is, how did things get down to this, not only for the UK or Europe, but for many other parts of the world, especially during Christmas? Putting COVID aside, the U.S.-backed Ukraine conflict is one major reason, driving up energy prices and hence inflation. Christmas is known to be a time of giving, yet major donations have been going to Ukraine instead of citizens of the donating countries. The Kiel Institute has tracked 93.8 billion euros from 40 countries. Out of that, 52.3 billion euros came from the United States, 29.2 billion euros from the European Union, and 12.3 billion euros from other countries, mostly the United Kingdom.
The salami tactic that Wang Yi is accusing the U.S. of using refers to a practice of using a series of small actions to achieve a much larger end goal that would otherwise be difficult to achieve using one large action. Yi's comments undermine the recent attempts by the leaders of the two biggest economies in the world to reconcile their differences when Joe Biden and Xi Jinping recently met. During Xi Jinping's first in-person meeting with the U.S. president since 2017, the issue of Taiwan was raised. China believes that the U.S. is slowly but surely trying to chip away at China's authority over Taiwan, the incredibly significant industrial island that China deems as its own territory. President Xi calls Taiwan its first red line that the U.S. would be wise not to cross. The intensity of the rhetoric used by both parties to describe the actions of the other party is also escalating. As Joe Biden objected to China's, quote, coercive and increasingly aggressive actions towards Taiwan, Wang Yi told Blinken that the U.S. shouldn't continue, quote, old routine of unilateral bullying. He also said that the U.S. should not be blinded by ideological prejudices and stop putting obstacles to bilateral relations. Prior to his phone call with Antony Blinken, Wang Yi had already met with the U.S. ambassador to China, Nicholas Burns. During that meeting, he noted that the U.S. and China cannot change each other, and the U.S. shouldn't think about thwarting China all the time. This kind of rhetoric is reflective of the frayed relationship between the two superpowers that are a result of U.S. crackdown on Chinese tech companies, human rights issues, and perhaps the most important of all, the issue of Taiwan, and the U.S. constantly undermining the One China policy. The U.S. has recently put major restrictions on some major Chinese tech firms, including Huawei and ZTE, to the point that their products, along with some other brands, can't even be exported to the U.S. The previous bans that were imposed on these companies during Donald Trump's presidency when anti-China rhetoric began were a lot less restrictive. On the topic of human rights, just in the wake of April's shooting incident in New York, the U.S. State Department released reports on human rights situation in other countries, including China, with a handful of accusations thrown in the mix. China rebutted Washington's claims against it by pointing out to its failures in upholding the very human rights they have always championed. The issue of Taiwan is a bit more complicated. In the website of U.S. Department of State, you will find the following paragraph on the U.S.'s supposed official position towards China and Taiwan. The United States' approach to Taiwan has remained consistent across decades and administrations. The United States has a long-standing one-China policy, which is guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, the three U.S.-China joint communique, and the six assurances. We oppose any unilateral changes to the status quo from either side. We do not support Taiwan independence, and we expect cross-strait differences to be resolved by peaceful means. While the document reads that the U.S. does not support Taiwan's independence, a July 2007 Congressional Research Service report confirms that U.S. policy does not, in fact, recognize China's sovereignty over Taiwan. The document further reads, consistent with the Taiwan Relations Act, the United States makes available defense articles and services as necessary to enable Taiwan to maintain a sufficient self-defense capability and maintain our capacity to resist any resort to force or other forms of coercion that would jeopardize security or the social or economic system of Taiwan. The Taiwan Relations Act was passed right around the time the U.S. recognized the People's Republic of China in 1979. Its intent was so that the U.S. can maintain commercial, cultural, and other relations with Taiwan through unofficial relations without government representation and without formal diplomatic ties. China has since viewed the TRA as, quote, an unwarranted intrusion by the United States into the internal affairs of China. As the U.S. continued to supply Taiwan with arms and more recently had official meetings with the leader of the island. And this is where Wang Yi's rhetoric towards Blinken starts to make sense. The U.S. has been playing fast and loose with China's sovereignty over Taiwan and the One China policy. China is on a short fuse, and it remains to be seen when their patience will run out.
An investigation has shed light on the complicity of social media giant Twitter in the propaganda of the U.S. military in the West Asia region. The investigation says Twitter helped the U.S. military amplify its propaganda campaigns in this region, allowing fake accounts to push pro-U.S. narratives. The probe has been carried out by a journalist and is based on internal documents released by Elon Musk, who took over as Twitter's CEO in October. Musk has released the documents as an effort to boost transparency about the social media platform's operations under the previous management. The investigation says Twitter secretly created a special whitelist exempting accounts run by US Central Command or CENTCOM for spam and abuse flags. The move allowed those accounts greater visibility on the platform. It says Twitter quietly introduced the feature in 2017. The measure was introduced after US military officials asked the company to improve the visibility of Arab language accounts used to amplify certain messages. Those included promoting US military narratives, anti-Iran messages, and support for the US and Saudi-backed war in Yemen. According to the report, CENTCOM concealed its ownership of the accounts. In some cases, it used fake pictures and bios to give them the impression that they were run by civilians in the region. The social media giant tolerated the presence of the accounts on the platform until at least May 2022. Twitter has long pledged to shut down all state-backed disinformation and propaganda efforts. For example, in 2018, Twitter suspended accounts that were allegedly linked to Russia's propaganda efforts. But these rules and suspensions have not been applied to the American military efforts.
And the story also looks at the kind of hypocritical promises and pledges by Twitter. Twitter, since 2016, has promised to crack down on state-backed influence operations to shut down covert propaganda, and they brag all the time about shutting down Russian or Venezuelan or even Thai secret Twitter accounts that are run by the military.
Azerbaijan,
yeah, Azeris are always doing this as well. Yeah. But really, the U.S. is doing this. And Twitter, even though they promised to shut down all state-backed influence operations, they've worked hand in glove with the U.S. military, giving them special privileges for their fake Twitter accounts, these fake personalities that kind of make organic-looking conversations in Yemen or Syria or Iraq.
The finding of this research appeared to corroborate a major report published in August by online security researchers affiliated with the Stanford Internet Observatory. That report claimed that thousands of accounts that they suspected to be part of a state-backed information operation. It said many of those accounts use photorealistic human faces generated by artificial intelligence and were connected with an online ecosystem that included fake news websites, meme accounts on Telegram and Facebook, and online personalities. They all echoed Pentagon messages and included anti-Iran messages. Some of them accused Iran of threatening Iraq's water security. Others promoted allegations that Iran was harvesting the organs of Afghan refugees. In the summer of 2020, officials from Facebook reportedly identified fake accounts attributed to CENTCOM's influence operation on its platform. Reports show in 2020, Facebook and Twitter executives were invited by the Pentagon's top attorneys to attend classified briefings in a sensitive, compartmented information facility. The result of that meeting was that many of the fake accounts remained active for at least another year. Some of the accounts on the CENTCOM list remain active even now.
Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has visited Washington in a much-publicized visit to the U.S. This is the first foreign visit that Zelensky has made to the U.S. since the war began back in February. During a meeting at the White House, President Joe Biden pledged to give more military support to Ukraine, including a new missile system.
As I said, Mr. President, you don't have to worry. We are staying with Ukraine as long as Ukraine is there. Thank you all.
The U.S. pledged $1.85 billion in military aid for Ukraine, including a Patriot missile system. Ukrainian officials have continuously called on the U.S. to deliver that system. Biden said the U.S. and Ukraine would continue to project a, quote, united defense against Russia as the war drags on. And as expected, the visit has drawn an angry response from Russia. Moscow's envoy to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov, has denounced the visit as a, quote, Hollywood-style trip, accusing Washington of throwing all of its colossal resources, weapons, and intelligence capabilities at Kiev. The Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov has said that there had been no signs of readiness for peace talks during Zelensky's visit. He further noted that this was evidence that the U.S. was fighting a proxy war with Russia, quote, to the last Ukrainian. The Pentagon has disclosed that the U.S. has sent $20 billion worth of military aid to Ukraine in 2022. The recent $1.7 trillion federal spending bill includes $45 billion that's earmarked for Ukraine in 2023. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu noted earlier that Kyiv had already received more than $97 billion worth of weapons and ammunition, and that Russia was already fighting the entire West and NATO. As the West, spearheaded by the U.S., continues to pour more military and economic aid packages to Ukraine, there are now calls for more transparency. In the U.S., Republicans are calling for plans to exercise oversight powers to scrutinize tens of billions of dollars that the U.S. has spent. Republicans have been more skeptical than their Democratic counterparts in the Senate about funding Ukraine's defenses. Some Republicans have cited corruption in Ukraine, saying that there are concerns about the aid going to the country. Prior to the Ukrainian president's remarks, a few Republicans had already made public their opposition to the spending bill and further aid to Ukraine. We should be focused on trying to contain the war, not expand the war. And this sends the message that we are kind of okay with expanding the war. And I think we should be sending a different message, is what Warren Davidson, a Republican congressman, has said. Another Republican congressman, Matthew Gaetz, has criticized Zelensky, saying that American politicians who indulge his requests are unwilling to put Ukraine first.
You've got Americans here at home that are demanding accountability on our southwest border. You've got crime rampant. You've got historic inflation. You have a litany of issues that we all are paying for at the behest of this administration. And no one can tell us where this money is going. My heart breaks for the Ukrainians, absolutely. But every American deserves to know where every single dollar has gone.
This comes amid a declining support of Republican voters for more military aid to Ukraine. In the latest poll, 33% of Republicans agreed with prolonged support compared to 61% of Democrats and 46% of independents.
Limelight. For the millions of people incarcerated in the U.S., freezing temperatures amid failing infrastructure can be deadly. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. The website of Truth Out wrote in this regard, "The cells don't have any heat, so they're sleeping with their clothes on," a woman named Regina told Truth Out of her son's experience in Hill Correctional Center in Illinois, the U.S., in early December, adding, "They're not heating the tires. There is no heat in the day room. There is no heat outside the showers. The water is cold. You can let it run for a little while and you may get a little warm, but it's not enough." Regina has felt the cold in the prison firsthand. "It's even cold in the visitor's room," she said, adding, "I don't have any hair right now because I have cancer. So I wear a head wrap or a hat, but I can't wear it in there." "Because you can't have anything on your head?" She wrote three letters to the warden requesting a medical exemption, but never heard back. She said, "So I go in there with nothing on my head. My head is freezing, but I want to see my son." As people across the U.S. brace for upcoming cold weather, many of those set to suffer the most are incarcerated in prisons and jails. Each winter, people in old, drafty facilities shiver for months in their cells, struggling to function and fearing for their health. They have no control over cell temperature and often little access to warm clothes or extra blankets. Inevitably, some outdated heating systems across the U.S. will fail, leaving people in dangerously frigid temperatures. This speaks to a much larger issue of the infrastructure in general of U.S. prisons. Jennifer Vollen-Katz, executive director of the John Howard Association, JHA, an Illinois-based citizen correctional oversight organization, told Truth Out, adding, "In Illinois, we have many really old, decrepit facilities that are unsafe and frankly unfit for human habitation." Both JHA and Chicago-based Uptown People's Law Center, UPLC, receive letters every winter from people incarcerated in dangerously cold prisons in Illinois. UPLC Executive Director Alan Mills told Truth Out that complaints come most frequently from the U.S. state's three maximum security prisons, the newest of which was built in the 1920s. He explained, "They're long past their design life. These are 100-year-old buildings which have been heavily and hard used and not maintained. They haven't had an HVAC system that works in any sort of modern sense installed in any of these prisons. So it's too hot in the summer and too cold in the winter." Mills said old heating systems are susceptible to breakdowns, which can leave people without heat for days or weeks. It's not like you can go to your neighborhood Home Depot and pick up a piece of hardware to heat a huge old building like this. They're complicated to buy and manufacture, and they only come from one place, he said. Cold conditions are worsened by policies in Illinois and other states that ban family members from sending packages to their loved ones. The only way to obtain additional blankets, sweatshirts, and other supplies beyond the bare minimum supplied by the prison is to purchase them from the commissary and overpriced and often understocked prison store. As climate change results in increasingly hot summers, hunger strikes and lawsuits have drawn attention to the deadly heat and lack of air conditioning in many prisons. Just this past November, an article in Environmental Health calculated for the first time that 13% of deaths in Texas prisons during warm months can be attributed to extreme heat. But cold can be deadly too. On Christmas morning 2003, Charles Platcher froze to death in a cell in Illinois Menard Correctional Center, which opened in 1878 and is one of the three maximum security prisons Mills said frequently hears complaints from. Platcher was on suicide watch with his regular clothes confiscated when the heat went out in his unit overnight. Regina's son spent years in Menard before being transferred to his current facility. She said, "That place is a hellhole, plain and simple as that." More recently, Jamal Crummell had hypothermia when he died last January in Dauphin County Prison, a jail serving the Harrisburg, Pennsylvania area. Days before his death, another man in the jail told his mother that his cell was so cold, ice formed on the inside of the window, and that people incarcerated on his ice-cold unit spend their days huddled in blankets in their cells, while officers walked the floor in winter coats. People incarcerated in another Pennsylvania jail had already faced similar conditions this year. "We have to wear double clothing to keep warm, especially in the cell," stated a November letter addressed to the Abolitionist Law Center and signed from all of us on Unit 3B in Allegheny County in Pittsburgh. The writers noted that in some cells on their unheated unit, you can actually see your own breath. People are walking around shivering, and it's causing people to be out of character and irritable and also cause health concerns. Unit 3B is suffering echoes, please head from jails and prisons around the U.S. year after year. desperate man wrote last January from his unit in Green Rock Correctional Center in Virginia in a letter that was shared with Truthout, "We have no heat in our cells. The vents don't work at all, so the walls are sweating, and our beds, clothes, and personal property is wet. We literally have water puddled up in our floors with water running down the walls. The moisture could make us sick or damage our electronics and personal items. It's really bad." After multiple people on the unit filed official grievances with the prison, documenting the broken heater and water, "They locked us down and are only letting us shower every 3 days," he wrote, adding, "They punished us for grieving this issue." Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
A few strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary. About 2 months later, both the new president and prime minister, Marty Rajai and Marty Bahonar, were martyred together in the middle of a meeting. Many of you may remember these things, but our dear young people did not see these things at that time. They do not have a correct awareness of the history and details of these events. Think about this, you dear young people, our dear children. About 2 months after those events, Marty Rajai and Marty Bahonar, the president and prime minister at the time, were assassinated in a meeting and were gone. Shortly afterwards, a number of senior commanders from the army and the guard corps were martyred in a plane crash. Martyr Fallahi, Martyr Fakuri, Martyr Kolahduz, and the like. So in less than 3 months' time, all these bitter events took place. All these terrible tragedies occurred. All these devastating blows struck us.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Which country do you know of, which government do you know of, that can stand up to all these events and not collapse? You, the judiciary, are part of such a system. The people stood firmly, Imam stood firmly, like Mount Damavand and the caring officials and the revolutionary youth stood firmly. They turned the situation around 180 degrees. They changed continuous defeat in the war into continuous victory. They cleared the munafiqeen from the streets. They helped the army and the IRGC to become more organized every day. And they returned the country to a normal situation. There is a point to pay attention to in this. When these events took place, whether it was the martyrdom of Marty Beheshti or in subsequent events, the enemies rejoiced. They were hopeful that the foundations of this revolutionary system were falling apart. But they were frustrated in this hope. They were frustrated that day. And this frustration and disappointment has been repeated for them many times during these four decades.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding